Welcome to Cover to Cover. This is Richard A. Lupoff.
And I'm Richard Walensky. And our guest is Norman Mailer. His most recent book is Picasso, Portrait of Picasso as a Young Man. Many other books in the career of Norman Mailer, including Oswald's Tale, Harlot's Ghost, The Armies of the Night, Naked and the Dead. A splendid, long literary career. Also ran for mayor of New York City. Got involved in a series of controversies. Has been a director. Directed a noir film, Tough Guys Don't Dance.
Bill never gets the title right, by the way.
Of all of your different careers as a novelist, as a biographer, as a writer of history as a novel, novel as history, journalist, what do you find the most fun?
Well, I think the most exciting is to be at work on a novel, but it's also the heaviest task. It's it can be scary. It takes the most out of your body. The main reason is that the questions are, there are more questions, there's more tension. The stress over a period of time can get to be very heavy indeed. Excuse me. It started every tour. I begin to come down with a throat, and so we're on the edge of it. Maybe I'll hold up to this hour. But anyway, trouble with writing a novel is that you can make serious mistakes. In other words, you can take your protagonist and send him to the wrong place on the wrong day. Let's say you can send him to India when you should have sent him to London. And 6 months later, you decide you don't know enough about India to really write about it properly, and you put him in the wrong place, and not enough is happening as you write. Because I'll tell you, I don't like to plot a novel completely in advance. The few times I've done that, I never finished the novel. You have to really, the novel has to grow with you. You have to discover the book as you write it. So it is exciting, but at the same time, it's physically taxing in a way that doing a biography is not.
Well, Picasso, your latest book, features as one of its main characters, and this is a biography, a woman named Fernand.
Fernand Olivier, yeah.
Yeah. What if you had written a novel about her? Had you considered that?
No, not for a moment. You know, if I'm doing a biography, what it suggests, among other things, is that I have enough respect for the person I'm doing the biography about that I'm not going to try to enter their head. Years ago, an old friend of mine, Jean Malachet, said to me, he's a novelist, and he said, you know, we novelists can write about any person on earth except one. And I said, what's that? And he said, a novelist greater than ourselves. And it carries over to a painter like Picasso. I don't want to enter his head. I'll do my best to circumscribe him, to write around him, to read everything available on him, to look very carefully at his drawings. I will guess what's going on in his head, and I'll tell the reader that. But when you're writing a novel, you're taking on the authority to enter someone's head. I didn't want to write the kind of book where Pablo was feeling kind of poor today. The dealer of Volar hadn't smiled when he passed him on the street. You know, that's such crap that I just didn't want to go near that. And that's almost always what happens if you're writing with someone who's larger than yourself. It dwindles you when you try to enter their mind. So it's far easier to just describe him like what he is, a mountain, and I'm describing the topography of this mountain in great detail, saying these are the paths up the mountain.
But what about a character who would be larger than yourself, like Harlot? I mean, there's a character on the scene.
Well, he's both larger than me and smaller in that he can't write. I mean, he writes, but he doesn't write as well as I do. So I feel I have a certain equality with him. You're talking about Harlot's Ghost, of course, for those who don't know.
Yeah, so you feel you can write about a character under those conditions?
Yeah, I can write about a general. I can write about a top man in the CIA. I may not write about him as well as I think I'm writing about him, but I certainly can make the effort. It's a matter of novel writing is entirely a matter of confidence. In a biography, you have much more to fall back on. You have the testimony of various witnesses and people, and you can. It's more like making. When I think of a biography, I think of the architecture of a biography. One reason that this book is Picasso, Portrait of Picasso as a Young Man, is precisely that his life from the time he's born until he passes through Cubism, and I end the book in 1916, yeah, has a shape and a form to it that's very novelistic. You can see the way he grows. He has triumphs, he has failures, but there is a structure to it. Whereas later on in life, his life got particularly episodic. He was doing one thing, he was doing another thing, and you can't trace it as carefully. Maybe people will in years to come, but I didn't see the pattern as clearly as I saw it in the first period. And also, I think his greatest painting, at least half, and maybe more than half, of his greatest painting occurs in the first third of his life. So it seemed natural.
I'd like to back away from Picasso just for the moment and ask a couple of questions about the early career of Norman Mailer. Your formal education was in a technical area, but from a very early age, I believe you were planning to write, and as early as age 18, there was a work called No Percentage, published in 1941. What was that?
I wrote a novel called No Percentage that was never published and never will be. It's terrible.
Written in 41.
Yeah, when I was 18. That summer I wrote it. But I wrote a story called The Greatest Thing in the World that was published. It won a story magazine contest when I was 18. And that's probably where the confusion came in. And that determined me to be a writer. I wanted to be a writer before that. What happened is all through high school, I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer. I used to build model airplanes, stuff like that. And then when I got to Harvard, I realized I didn't really want to be an engineer. I was much more interested in writing. But by the time I decided, absolutely, I don't want to be an engineer. I want to be a writer. I was halfway through college. So I just kept taking the minimum of engineering courses and then took whatever I wanted, which was great fun. I took a lot of writing courses.
Did you have any inspirational professors, any idols who caused you to become the kind of writer you were?
No, but I had some very good writing teachers. I had a man named Ted Morrison, who was very good. There was a man whose name is known in literary circles, Robert Gorham Davis. He was excellent. And then finally I had Robert Hillier, who was a poet, and also very good. Those three were very good. And in fact, I even remember my freshman writing teacher, a man named Simpson. I forget his first name. But in any event, the act of taking a writing course every year for 4 years at Harvard limited the rest of my education a bit, but it kept me writing. I was writing the entire time through college.
There is controversy over whether anybody can teach anybody to write at all, that maybe the entire enterprise is a farce, and you either find it within yourself or it's just not there. How do you feel about
that? Well, I think they leave something out of account. You develop a sense of an audience when you take a writing course. That's the main virtue of it. You can have a good teacher or a bad teacher, and it helps a lot if the teacher is a good one and has an instinct on when to criticize you and when to compliment you. But the key thing is you begin to learn that when you write something, people are going to have 360 degrees of reaction to it. And that toughens you up in a way, because in the beginning, people are terribly afraid to write, since their fear is, my God, if I write what's in my head, they'll come in and kill me. And, you know, it takes a few years for writers to realize that actually the reverse is true. You can write something absolutely scandalous, shocking, what have you, and nobody pays any attention. That's the second blow that young writers receive, that they're less scary than they thought. First, they're afraid of how scary, how much they have to be afraid of what's in their head. And then later they realize there's nothing in my head that seems to scare anyone.
Well, Norman Mailer seems to have alternated between being the darling of the critics and the literary establishment and their favorite punching bag. I'm thinking of the Ancient Evenings incident and the infamous or famous New York Times book review ad.
Yeah. Well, I've had, somebody was just talking to me the other day and said, and he's had a life filled with accolades, and I muttered, and brickbats.
Indeed.
And I think if I counted my reviews over the last 30 years and all the books I've done, with the exception of one book, probably The Executioner Song, which generally received very good reviews, with all the other books, I'd say my reviews have been 50-50. And 50 good, 50 bad for each book. And I'm accustomed to it by now. Just to go back to the book on Picasso for a moment.
Yes.
The reviews here have been startling because I've received some very good ones, and bad, but the bad ones have been the worst reviews I've seen since Barbary Shore when I was 28 years old. And I can't quite conceive of the nerve I've touched, because I happen to be very fond of this book. I think it's one of the most interesting books I've written, and I can't figure out what happened with them. Why did they get that angry, you know?
Well, I wonder perhaps if a violently negative review is itself a sign that the book has power and is influencing readers, whereas lukewarm reviews or being completely ignored would be the real insult.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, that's fine, and I've arrived at that conclusion myself, I promise you. But nonetheless, when you received two deadly reviews, one in the Daily New York Times and then in the Sunday Times, and they're both syndicated. It's not my ego that I'm worried about at that point. It's my wallet.
Oh, I understand. Richard Walensky, you had a question.
Yeah. Moving on with in your career a little bit, you were one of a series of writers who for whom World War II was some kind of inspirational starting point in their career. And I'm thinking here of Gore Vidal, Joseph Heller, James Jones, Kurt Vonnegut. The list can go on. Leon Uris, James Michener, Herman Wouk. Of these writers, first of all, do you know all of them?
More or less, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know Uris. Never met him.
What do you think about World War II as that point, and has there been any point down the road after that that might compare? And when I say that list, it still astonishes me, because even the least of these writers is a giant compared to a lot of the people coming down the pike today.
We all had the same experience, so that we were a generation. And that's crucial. It created us as a generation. Vietnam hasn't had the same effect on young writers because Vietnam divided the country. And so that experience is a double one. For some, it was the war in Vietnam, and for some, it was the war against the war in Vietnam. And so you don't have that simple generational sense that is a true point of reference. Don't forget, it wasn't just that we were in the war, but our readers had been in the war. And so we all were in connection with one another. I can't think of any other period in American letters when not only were all these books written, and a good many of them were damn good, but they all did very well. You know, a lot of careers were launched by that. That did not happen with the war in Vietnam. A few very good writers have come out of that war, but they just, you can't say their careers were launched. Most people don't know their name to this day.
Well, if you talk about a writer like Michael Herr, who wrote Dispatches,
yeah.
You know.
Well, I mean, it's a wonderful book, but he didn't get, and he got very, very good reviews, but it didn't launch his career. I think Tim O'Brien came out a little better, but same thing with Tim.
One curious fact was that this was a war that everybody felt had to be fought, and yet we look at the work of Vonnegut, we look at the work of Heller, we look at yours, and you're all very anti-war.
There's something about being in war that tends to make you anti-war. It's not a, there are very few people who love it. I always was taken with Apocalypse Now because, Coppola caught those few guys who do love war. You know, that dance of the helicopters is just incredibly memorable. But generally speaking, I remember war in the Maine as just being, well, you know, your bowels were always a real consideration. Fatigue was a huge matter. You're covered with mud if you were in the Philippines, as I was, and in the, the living conditions were just so damn crummy. That part of the hatred of war was, why didn't they give us better living conditions? The Army learned that lesson. Apparently, it's much better to be at war now.
Yet at the same time, this was the great war that had justification as opposed to all the ones that came after.
Well, I sometimes think of, I obviously had a lot of animosity toward the Army, and it was an institution that was tailor-made for me. But at the same time, I believe the war essentially was okay. I still do. I feel that war had to be fought, and just as well we fought it. I wonder what I would have felt like if I'd hated the war. I often thought, what would have been like if I'd been in Vietnam and hated this war? My God, that would have been horrible. But the irony, of course, is that in Vietnam, with all the horrors, the soldiers, generally speaking, had more of a good time as well as a horror time. I mean, it was a time filled with good times and horrors. And therefore, a more interesting war in many ways than our war, which was dull and full of slogging. I can remember going on endless patrols, 3-4 patrols a week, which we'd cover 15 miles and come back 8 hours later just covered with mud. And it wasn't, it was more of a physical feat than it was a combat. So, you know, it wasn't agreeable. It wrecked your liver. It did bad things to you. People got very ill from that war.
We're talking on Cover to Cover with Norman Mailer. Dick Lupoff.
I wonder, obviously your war experiences did not make you an outright pacifist.
No, I'm still not a pacifist. I'm not a pacifist. I mean, I believe there's such a thing as a war that's better than not fighting a war. I felt that way about the war with Iraq. You know, there was a lot that was very unhappy about that war, and there were horrors in that war. But I think if we hadn't fought that war, we would have had to fight a bigger one down the road.
Mm-hmm. This makes me think in an oddly circular fashion of Einstein, who called himself a pacifist but also justified fighting Hitler, mm-hmm. and managed in some way to reconcile those two positions, which I can look at each of them separately and agree with him, and yet I have a hard time putting them together. But this in turn brings us back to the new book on Picasso, which I must say I'm among those who love the book.
Oh, good.
I think it's just wonderful. But the question I believe has come up in comparing Picasso and Einstein as to who is the great genius of the 20th century.
I think it would depend on your occupation and your interests. For scientists, there'd be no question Einstein's the greatest of man of the 20th century. If you're trying to understand life as opposed to understanding the cosmos, then give me Picasso. In other words, Picasso had all these extraordinary abilities. For one thing, he had the most, from my point of view, the most incredible street smarts of any artist of any category I've ever encountered. I mean, he truly understood people, and he understood people in all sorts of ways that most people don't. I mean, I look at his paintings to get insight into people. So in that sense, he was marvelous. Einstein, was not comprehensible to most of us. And therefore, for scientists, he changed the nature of science in the 20th century. And since the 20th century is a century that's been moving more and more and more into technology, I think on balance, you'd have to say he's the greatest person of the 20th century. But I much prefer dealing with Picasso than with Einstein.
But I wonder now, Picasso, particularly in terms of cubism, and I'm relying very largely on Norman Mailer's book because I don't know nearly as much about Picasso as I would like to. But he seems to be so interested in taking things apart and seeing how they work and seeing how the structure of the universe works. Of course, he sees it in graphic form. Einstein saw it in some sort of mathematical form. But in a peculiar way, I seem to think they're doing the same thing.
Well, they're each trying to come up with a unified vision of existence. Einstein was doing it by looking to find, the general theory of relativity, which followed the special theory of relativity, looked to connect space, time, light, energy, mass, and gravity. And Einstein didn't succeed in getting that general theory of relativity, but that was his effort all his life. Picasso was looking to find a synthesis in all visual things so that when you look at a cubist painting, look at the best of them, what you find is you're looking at many, many things at once. You're looking at a landscape. You're looking at a still life. You're looking at a female torso. You're looking at a city. You're looking at a cadaver that's being dissected. You're looking possibly, someone once suggested to me, maybe what one's looking at is what life looks like when you're first born. And it occurred to me that's absolutely valid. There's something in what he's doing that's eerie and extraordinary and nicely upsetting, to which you're in contact with some extraordinary effort to comprehend existence. And it's almost breathing at you as you look at these canvases.
Is this a mystical phenomenon?
No, I think he was very... very direct. He was, I don't know, he's on the borderline. He's talking about mysticism. Picasso, there's a famous speech he made to, he was talking to André Malraux, and he was talking about how the first time he discovered African masks. And he then got into saying, I understood these masks immediately. They were intercesseurs. He said they were mediators. And he said, I now understand the French word, intercesseurs. They were there. They were put there to keep evil spirits away. He said, and that is what I do all the time. Suddenly I realize I'm the same as these people who make the mass. This is what I do. I keep evil spirits away. He had a sense of catastrophe all the time, and a lot of his work was precisely to hold off evil forces. He's a man who lived in dread.
There's one more aspect of, and I know my partner Richard Walensky is just chopping at the bit, so I'll just one more and then give the microphone back. There's a section very early in your book in Picasso in which there is this amazingly poignant moment in which you talk about why he had such a hard time learning arithmetic, because he would look at the number 7, and instead of perceiving it as a quantitative or mathematical concept, he would see an inverted nose.
Yes.
Such a striking moment in your book. If you would just talk about that a little bit.
He started drawing, you know, before he could speak. The first word that came out of his mouth was lapis, pencil. And then his father was an academic painter of some medium skills, who was like a failed athlete who became a coach for his more talented son. And so Picasso was taught to draw at a very early age. And he saw things visually, always. Forms were what appealed to him. He's absolutely fascinated with the way if a tree looked like a woman upside down, then there were profound relations between a tree and a woman upside down. And he lived with this. Most of us live with words, so it's not automatic for us to understand that there are people who understand more with their eyes than with their mouth. But he was one of them.
But again, it strikes me that there's a truth here which transcends the immediate application. When I read that section of your book, I immediately thought that a writer, either a journalist or a novelist, perceives the life experience as story. Mm. Everything has beginnings and middles and ends, and narrative structure, which to another person, well, you know, I'm just cooking dinner. In a strange way that we're doing the same thing in a different medium, but it's the same thing that's being done.
Well, we're perceiving that that's similar, and writers tend to look for narrative, but painters, I think, tend to look for visual connections. And that's not the same thing exactly. I don't know that I'd agree with you there.
Oh, yeah. Okay, Richard.
Well, continuing a little with the parallel, as I was reading Picasso, your book on Picasso, I kept getting struck by certain similarities between the life of Norman Mailer and the life of Pablo Picasso. Picasso moved in new directions, created a synthesis in Cubism. In your career, you created a synthesis or worked with others. I think people like Tom Wolfe and Hunter Thompson were working on similar ways, but you created a synthesis of nonfiction and fiction writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we never, Hunter and Tom Wolfe and I never had any personal contact. We never worked together in any way. We just happened to be, you know, there's a notion of the zeitgeist, that there's a certain spirit, and this spirit pulls artists in, and they all work in the same direction. Braque and Picasso, for instance, worked independently, working their way independently into Cubism, and when they saw how close they were in their thinking, they worked together for a while, which is they show each other their work each day and work together very closely. But, you know, what we were all doing was finding this way that it seemed to us that if you put yourself into a story and make yourself one of the characters in the story, that everything that you covered journalistically was much enriched, because what's always left out of journalism, and I find journalism rather empty and yawning without it, is you don't know the personality of the writer. What's the use of listening to something that's written, reading something that's been done in a hurry if you don't know anything about the writer? You know, the story's empty.
Is the Norman Mailer the character of, say, Armies of the Night? Is that the real Norman Mailer, or is that a fictional person?
There's no author ever has put anyone else or themselves into a book and been totally accurate. What you want, when you write a book, you try to create a character who's alive in the book. And you really don't worry while you're writing how true it is. I'll give you another example. I tried to write about everyone in The Executioner's Song as accurately as I possibly could. I called it a novel because I thought it was in the form of a novel, but I wanted it to be absolutely as accurate to the facts as I could find those facts. And yet there were any number of people who were pleased or displeased with their portrait, but they didn't feel that was quite them. And my thing was, well, all right, I did my best. That's as close as you ever come to anyone. So the same thing is true with the Armies of the Night. That's a Norman Mailer. You know, each of you have many Richards in you. It's not as if one can define you definitively with one pen portrait.
Well, you continued after Armies of the Night with similar works, and then you stopped. Why did you stop?
I just got tired of it. I thought, I didn't really stop completely until I did The Executioner Song. And then I thought, it was just, put it this way, it was the context. there were a lot of people saying, well, that's the only way he can write. The only way he can write is about himself. So I thought, well, the hell with Ollie. I'll show you I can write in another way altogether. You know, one of my favorite remarks is one that Andre Gide once meant, which is, please don't understand me too quickly. And there's an arrogance in book reviewers and critics that never fails to astound me. I don't know where they think they know as much as they pretend to know. You know, a writer, and it doesn't have to be me, any writer can work, a good serious writer can work on a book for 2, 4, 7, 10 years, and then somebody comes along and reads it in a hurry, groaning at the length because they're being paid by the book, not the number of hours they put in, and so they skim it, and then they write a definitive verdict on it, revealing usually their incompetence rather than their critical powers.
One aspect of...
And reincarnation, but I felt this was... parenthetically, the Egyptians didn't. Which is interesting. But I felt here, this was much more specific than reincarnation, and it didn't involve, you didn't have to go on some mystic trip to express it. I mean, the man is reincarnating himself physically through cohesion. So, as I say, I thought that was nifty. Quite a feat.
Ancient Evenings is different from your other works in that it does deal with this ancient civilization for which some, but not much, remains that we can decipher to bring out the day-to-day life. So it almost becomes a science fiction for you to write it.
Well, it's the reverse of science fiction. It's going backwards instead of forward. But yes, it's as unrelated to our lives as science fiction. I was interested at the time in separating out for myself everything that was the Judeo-Christian tradition that I've been writing in, as opposed to everything that came before it. So my test through the book was to cut out the anachronisms, because as you start writing a book like that, you discover an untold number of anachronisms that creep into what you're writing, and I wanted to get them out. And it was almost like a chase through the weeds, you know, weeding a garden. Every time I went through that book, I'd find one more anachronism on a page, that sort of thing. But I wanted to try to create a state of mind that existed before our present culture began.
How did Egyptologists take your book?
Well, to my surprise, the only contact I had that way was I gave a talk at the University of Pennsylvania before a number of Egyptologists. And to my surprise, a few of them said, you know, Mayer's pretty much on the mark. His book's not bad, which is, you know, that pleased me because people who are experts in a profession do not look lightly on people invading their turf.
As witness the reviews of Picasso.
Well, I did get a great many good ones, you know, but the what characterizes all the bad ones is all the bad ones came from the art establishment. So a couple of good ones came from the art establishment, and the other good ones came from people who were not directly related to that nexus of power that's the art establishment. Don't forget that there's a huge amount of money back of that art establishment. You have collectors who are enormously wealthy. Now, I don't mean that everyone thought, I'm going to write a book and wreck their investments. It's subtler than that. The thing is that when people have a lot of power, they don't like the given being changed unless they're the ones who are changing it. And so there was a feeling that I was invading from the outside, and how dare I? You know, a large part of that was just huge. It was the spleen of an ugly establishment expressing itself.
A question to revert for a moment to ancient Egypt, ancient evenings. How did you do the research before you wrote that book?
Oh, I spent 11 years writing that book. And so what I'd do is I'd read a section, and then I'd write it, and then I'd come to another section. And it was all sorts of research. None of it was easy. The research was more difficult in that book than any book I've written. Egyptologists very often are not the nicest, most comfortable writers in the world to follow. Some of the books are almost impenetrable. You really have to work very, very hard on them. There's something called the Lepsius Denkmaler, which is a huge anthology of books, about 11 books. Each of them, when opened, would be the size of this table, like, you know, 5.5 feet by 2.5 feet. When you open them, they had huge, they were printed in Germany around 1840. And when you turn the pages, it was like a sail flapping. It was incredible. They were made of some sort of canvas or heavy linen. And anyway, they had all the drawings that you found in all the tombs of each period. And that was extraordinary stuff. The detail, it was wonderful. For instance, when I had to do the Battle of Kadesh, which is the major battle in the book and takes up a good 50 pages of the book at least, These drawings gave you an intimate sense of the camp life. There were little drawings of one pack mule or stallion on top of another. You know, horses mating, lions running beside the pharaoh, not lions, a lion running beside the pharaoh, soldiers cooking. So it gave you, these were extraordinary moments and taught you an awful lot about what the life in Egypt was like. Finally, you had to use your imagination to put it together.
Did you study the Egyptian language at all?
I tried to. I learned enough about it to realize that there's some extraordinary elements in the Egyptian language. And one of them is that they had 1,000 words for copulation, which is why there's a scene in the book where Menenhetep, the man who's born many times, in his first life, he makes love to the pharaoh's queen. And she goes wild, and she starts talking to him and using all these words. So she says, "Oh, my boat, my coffin, my field," and goes on with 100 different words. My musical instrument, so forth. And it's semi-comic, but it was also intended to be the number of words one could apply to an act of copulation.
Well, but there is the notion that our language shapes the way we think, which in turn shapes the way we perceive and understand the universe and deal with it.
I'd agree, absolutely. And their language was, I learned enough about their language to know that they absolutely saw things in different ways. You know, it was a primitive language, and therefore they tend to see things in terms of montage. You know, primitive languages usually have much less emphasis on tense than we do. I've noticed, for instance, in classical Hebrew, the past tense and the future tense are distinguished only by putting an "and" in front of the verb. If you say "he went," that's past tense. If you say "and he went," that's future. That's the only difference. And I thought about it for a long time. It seemed to me that in dreams, we do not distinguish between past and future. And so for a primitive, they're really only two. When you don't have clocks around, you don't have schedules, you don't have any of that stuff, you don't have technology, then there are really only two tenses. There's the here and now, and there's that other tense, that other time, that what happened yesterday may not quite have happened yesterday so much as been an augur of what's going to happen tomorrow. Because for a primitive, what happened yesterday is almost as spooky as what's happening tomorrow.
It's just the now and the
not
now.
The now and the other. The now and the other.
It's like a dot with a circle around it.
Yeah.
And the circle is the other and the dot is the now.
Yeah.
Let us move on, if we may, to A Fire on the Moon. Your feeling about the entire space enterprise of our century.
Well, I had a lot of feelings at the time. I don't know that that much has happened one way or the other. It's still ongoing, of course. I think they had huge ambitions at the time, and what with economic troubles and the Cold War and this and that, they never quite got the development they were looking for. I think they're probably behind schedule. I expect they were looking to be in orbit around Mars by now rather than around the moon. They still don't have a space station on the moon.
Do you see this as a great enterprise for humankind, or is it just a little side trail?
I have the same difficulty with it now that I had when I was writing that book, which is it was very hard to decide if this was a noble enterprise or a folly. And when you consider everything that's wrong on Earth, it seems like a folly to devote that much attention to the other. On the other hand, at the rate at which we're poisoning the Earth, it may be that these spaceships are the only way a few people are going to get out. They'll have to recolonize in some other planets in 50 years from now. You know, that's what I'm getting at. That used to be just a scenario over the horizon. Now it's a little closer. As you get older, you begin to realize the depth of ugliness in the human soul. You begin to wonder, well, maybe we will destroy the whole damn thing. Maybe we are going to have to move on. Maybe this is some deep impulse, some instinct in humans that they have to get ready to migrate. And one of the things about Picasso that always got me is precisely that he gives you such a dark view of human nature before he's done, not only with the people he draws and paints, but of himself. His view of himself is as ugly as it is of anyone else. You end up with this sense that he is pointing out to us how bad we are, how very bad we are, and how if we're going to get through the toils and rapids and possible disasters of this period, how far we have to go, how with what ugly material all of us are working, which is ourselves.
But this was a challenge to strive rather than simply a message of despair, was it not?
Yes. Oh, ostensibly. Well, I mean, not even ostensibly. It actually was a huge achievement. It was a fantastic achievement. But there's an emptiness lagging behind it now. You know, if you remember, no one felt any joy compared to the magnitude of the event. I remember when the event occurred, there wasn't that much happiness on Earth. People didn't say, wonderful, we're on the moon, we're a fantastic species. There was more a feeling of, what are we doing? Why are we on the moon? I always had felt a great ambivalence about that project. And in writing the book, I had to live with that ambivalence. I didn't know if I approved of it or detested it. It was very hard to tell.
And this, in a very, very strange way, does relate to Picasso and what you've written about him.
Well, Picasso never made up his mind whether he really thought people were beautiful or hideously ugly. He painted all his women in both fashions. You know, he captured their beauty and he captured their ugliness. And he did the same for himself. They're wonderful self-portraits of himself when he's a young man. And then by the end of his life...
Oh, yes. He just looks like a movie star in some of them.
Yeah, and he was. He was very handsome. And then you get, toward the end of his life, the ugliness. He was still a good-looking old man, but the ugliness of his portraits is unbelievable. And he searched always. One of the things that I liked about his ugly portraits of women, like is not the word, but one of the things I respected in it, is he wasn't just talking about the woman. He was talking about how bad the relationship had become. It was as if he was painting the relationship rather than the woman.
You refer to his many, many styles of work, and each of which alone would have been a triumph. And again, I hope I'm not being presumptuous to perceive a metaphor there for Norman Mailer, who started out as this war novelist and has done so many different things. I think some people may resent that, but others think that this in itself is part of the achievement.
Well, as I say, I think I said this a little earlier today, what attracted me to Picasso in the first place is that he gave me sanction. I saw how many styles in which he'd worked, and when I was younger, I used to be bothered by the fact that I didn't seem to have a métier. I didn't seem to have a theme that unified my work. And then I realized, finally, the only theme for certain people, like Picasso, and in a much smaller way, like for myself, is that the theme is that we're developing, we're trying to develop a vision of existence. And so no matter what direction we go in, the attempt to uncover that vision is always present. So in that sense, one's work does have a unity. And I got an awful lot from Picasso just by knowing that about him, that you can work in many styles.
Just jotting down quickly some of your better-known works here. We have Naked and the Dead, which is the war novel, Armies of the Night, which is the journalism, Harlot's Ghost, which is a massive, massive contemporary or historical novel. It spans years, but it seems to be, for the Cold War era, what so many books have tried to be to enwrap, say, the West, because I think the Cold War has become mythic in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got your biographies of Marilyn Monroe and Picasso. Looking through all of that, do you see, have I left anything out? Executioner's Song?
Yeah, Oswald.
Yeah.
And then shorter pieces, you know, pieces on people like Jack Kennedy, Jackie Kennedy, when she was married to him, Madonna. I can think of a few. Henry Miller.
Through all of those, if you could find one book that would stand out as being the quintessential Norman Mailer, is there one?
No, but, you know, again, keeping all proportions on it, I'd hate to point to one painting of Picasso's and say
that's the only one.
Picasso. What's characteristic about Picasso is he didn't work in one direction but two. Two at any given moment. In the depths of the Blue Period, he was doing some of the best of his pornographic drawings. At the same time, he was abysmally depressed. So, it's startling to see how many different directions he would work in at the same time. In the middle of drawing incredibly ugly portraits of women, he might do a classical study of them, which are worthy of a painter like Ang. So I'd hate to think that any one of my books is quintessential. It's rather, any one of my books is an aspect of what I do.
Okay, when you were working on this book, Picasso, you must have also been working somewhat, at least, on, I guess, Oswald's Tale. There must have been some overlap.
Well, this book was written 3 years ago.
Okay.
The major part was written 3 years ago, and then I had a lot of trouble getting permissions. It was very tough getting into that world, that world of the art establishment, and getting permissions. And so that delayed the book. And while it was delayed, I wrote Oswald's Tale. By the time Oswald's Tale came out, I was working again on this and finishing it off. But essentially, I'd say two-thirds, three-quarters of the book was written 3 years ago.
Do you work on one book at a time, or do you work
usually
on
multiple? I do. In this case, okay. It was different.
What are you working on now?
Well, I'm trying to write the second volume of Harlot's Ghost, because if you remember, at the end of it, it says to be continued. After 1,400 pages, I say to be continued, and there are not many readers who forgave me for that one.
So you're working on the sequel?
Yeah.
In the end, how many books will it be? Just the two or three?
No, the next one better finish it.
We've closed an era with the end of the Cold War, and we're entering a new era. Does Norman Mailer have anything to say about where we're going?
I don't know where we're going. I'm terrified about where we're going because I think this country is a mess at this point, just a spiritual mess. I think we have bad ecology here, but we have very bad spiritual ecology here. Cold War is a large part of that. Because for 40 years, we all were comfortably aligned in a magnetic field where we all were hating the same thing, the evil empire. There was communism, that godless, materialistic universe that we had to combat. And, you know, the amount of bourgeois in that was not to be believed. you know, what we were dealing with was a poor, oppressive, huge country that was at the level of a third world country. They happened to have a powerful KGB and they had a powerful army. That was the reason why those endless nuclear, those fission things were being built all the time. We didn't need them. We had 10 times, each country had 10, 20 times the power needed to destroy the world. But we kept building them because that was the best way to bankrupt them. And we bankrupted them. That's how we won the Cold War. Well, when it ended, a great switch was thrown. And the magnetic firings are now no longer all pointing in the same direction. But for 40 years, they've been used to being filled with hate toward the enemy. So, which is why this country is now in a kind of collateral chaos. Everybody's hating everybody. There's more animosity in public life now than I can ever recall. Every group, every clique is now at war with every other one. If we get into a depression, I'm just scared of what's going to happen. Because, you know, with the crunch now on the safety net being removed, you could have riots in the ghettos in a depression. And if you have that, you're going to have barbed wire. And once you have the barbed wire, you're going to have the press being closed down. And before you know it, we'll have a fascism. And the only thing we can be certain of in that fascism is that whatever it's called, it won't be called that. Now, that's the worst scenario. I'm hoping that there's every reason to hope for it, that we'll muddle through economically and we won't have that crunch. But if we get into a crunch, there's nothing here to hold it off.
All of the...
I'm gloomy.
All of the constraints have been removed.
Yeah. The safety net's been removed, and there's no left. You know, the left is fragmented now into small power groups who each has their own agenda, and there's no vision any longer on the left. There's just a kind of despair and a lack of comprehension. And, I mean, the rich are taking over everything. Not the rich, the corporations. And you know, everybody's getting money mad, which is... The worst kind of, I mean, capitalism has always been able to exist so long as the products were good. But now there's no interest in the products. It's the marketing that counts. So I'm not terribly optimistic.
You were once or described yourself as a left conservative.
Left conservative.
This doesn't sound like a left conservative to me.
Why not? I believe that the trouble with the left always was that they threw everything conservative out. And what's wrong with the conservatives is that they're never true to the notion that what's important is that traditions be maintained. In fact, the conservatives have done more to destroy the fiber of this country than the left because they've been money mad. And a good conservative is not money mad, not money mad at all. Once marketing products becomes everything, you don't care what you do to sell them. That's not conservatism. So the conservatives have destroyed family life. You ask me how? I'll tell you how. Through commercials on television. You know, we live a life where every 7 minutes, if we're watching something and kids no longer read, so they watch television, they're interrupted by a commercial. Well, that makes you violent. We all know if we're interrupted when we want to say something, we get a little angry. Just take a tough young kid who's full of potential violence and interrupt them all the time, and you'll see what will happen. And that's what we're doing. You know, if there was a clamp down on television, and the only thing you could show on television is Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. what would happen is all the kids would get to the point where they'd want to off Rebecca because of the interruptions of the commercials. So, you know, media is part of our difficulty because, advertising is interruption.
Well, one final question to Norman Mailer, who's had such a distinguished career. Do you see yourself finding yet another area, or do you think you're just going to stick with biography and fiction from here on out?
I think the likelihood that I'll stick with it is greater than ever before. If somebody came along and said, direct a movie, I'd say, you bet, let's do it. Because unless I were in the middle of a novel and felt it was truly important for me that I keep working at it, I love making movies. That's the only way I can put it. So But I don't think anyone's going to come knocking on my door and saying, here's $5 million, $10 million bucks to make a movie. So odds are I will be writing a fiction and biography for the rest of my days. No way to feel sorry for myself with that situation.
We've been talking on Cover to Cover with Norman Mailer, whose latest book is Picasso, Portrait of Picasso as a Young Man. Richard Walensky.
I just wanted to say the title is Portrait of Picasso as a Young Man, but you made a natural error because we got that huge Picasso on the front of the book.
I'm Richard Walensky with Richard A. Luboff.